Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a double feature. First, a question and answer session which followed a special screening of the 2015 documentary film Son of the Congo, directed by Adam Hutnick. This will be followed by a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2014 documentary film Mimi and Donna, directed by Sophie Sartain. That discussion will center on parents and family members who have an adult child with developmental disabilities. This program, presented in collaboration with the Omaha Talents Academy and the Meyer Foundation for Disabilities, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 16, 2016, and Tuesday evening, March 1, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. On the first half of the program, the members of the panel will be the director of the film, Adam Hutnick, and Kwang Duloni, founder and director of the Omaha Talents Academy. Son of the Congo takes us into the world of Serge Ibaka, who escaped the violence of the Congo in 2008 to become an NBA superstar with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Following his success, he has returned home with the goal to help rebuild a country and inspire a new generation. Here now to introduce the program is Brian Wilson, president of the Omaha Talents Academy, and the film's director, Adam Hutnick.
Omaha Talents started about 3 years ago. And how it started was with my man here, is Kwang Duloni. You want to stand up? Well, how it started is Kwang, he said... You know, there was a need for a mentorship program, okay? And how it started was Kwang had one or two kids from the South Sudanese community, and he was taking them to the park and shooting hoops. Next week, it was four kids. Other week, it was 10 kids. Then the following week, it was 20 kids. And he said, wait a minute, it's getting pretty big, so we need to really have, we have something here. So fast forwarding up to today, we have over 100 kids that we mentor from the South Sudanese community. So now what we're doing is we're partnering up with Film Streams, Kaneko, and other folks in the community to try to service a need for the South Sudanese community.
I didn't know too much about Serge Ibaka when I got the call from some people I'd worked with before at ESPN saying Serge is probably going back to Congo and might be willing to let a camera go and, you know, do you want to go and see what happens? And we had about 4 weeks to plan a production in Congo, and this is what came out of it. And it's a life changer, hopefully for you as well as for me.
Oh, okay. We've got a question right off the bat.
At what point did you start following the boy for the parallel story to Serge? And how did you find that boy?
So most of what this production was we had no idea what was going to happen. Serge, when he goes, there's relatively little planning, and he's going to see some family, and he's going to check in on some of the projects he's involved with. But there's, like, we thrive on daily schedule and call times, and there's none of that. So we didn't really know very much. We knew we were just going to follow Serge. The one thing that I did want to try to do was to try to incorporate in the film a sense of what was it like to grow up as Serge. So I knew, we shot this all in 9 days. So we went in knowing I wanted to find a park that he used to play at, and I wanted to find a kid who in some way reflected some of what I understood Serge's childhood to have been like. So we just, I mean, that was the playground that you saw in the film. We went out one morning and just talked to a few kids, and this kid told me about helping his mom out with work and a little bit about his family, and I just, you know, saw that he was playing barefoot, and this was pretty close. And, you know, Serge was staying in a hotel, and just his life is no longer reflective of what life in Congo is really like, and he'd be the first person to tell you that. So that was one thing I really wanted to do, and we got lucky with Ricardo for sure.
Kwang, I'm wondering, could you share with folks who are unfamiliar a little bit about your story and, you know, how you came to basketball?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Brooke, Filmstream, it's, you know, thank you for, I guess, creating this opportunity. I think this kind of exchange, at least for me, being from the Sudanese community here, doesn't happen nearly enough in our city. And what I saw right away was, I mean, an incredible story that directly relate to, I guess, in ways, my life story and some of the things that I do with kids now, to where it's really a unique opportunity for a lot of great things to be shared, you know, and for our city and us individuals to grow from it. A lot of what I do, I'm the director and the founder of the Omaha Talents Academy. Been working with Sudanese kids since 2012. We are mentorship based. And, you know, really, I guess just one of the most important things for me, you know, is that I think most of us are well aware of just the strong and growing presence of African refugees here in Omaha, you know, whether it's Somali, you know, or from South Sudan, which is where I'm from. This has grown into becoming our largest population outside of Africa right here. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really realizing is just, you know, just the whole continent of Africa, you know, to where very distant, very different, you know, and a lot of things that are still yet to be understood about Africa and about being African, you know. And for me, feeling like we're in a position to be ambassadors for the whole continent, to where Africa is so much more than just a geographic location. You know, Africa is really a very unique way of, you know, I guess a perception of looking at life, you know, a way of experiencing life, you know, and it's something that's very much alive within me, you know, even though I've been living here for 16 years, and it's very much alive within the entire, just the fabric and the DNA of the African community here, you know, and I guess the intent, you know, of what I do with the talents is to eventually be in position to not only take, you know, and receive so much from this great country and city, but to be able to give back, you know, and offer our own unique, I guess, expression. So what we do is we work with young men, and I guess just a basic overview is we pretty much do everything that we can to make sure they're in position to be successful adults, and that can take on many, many different forms.
How did you deal with the security? I'm African, and I just kept thinking there was something around the corner. So how did you handle the security in your filming and everything? I mean, he's a superstar. He's going around.
Where are you from?
Nigeria.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's. I haven't been in Nigeria, but it can be very different from place to place. And actually, between Brazzaville and Kinshasa was a very different situation and a different need for security. But you know, one thing that we learned pretty quickly was, though sometimes there were situations that felt very claustrophobic and intense, the things that you'd be scared of in crowds here aren't necessarily scary the same way. And so, you know, we had drivers, we had some amount of security, but there's just a whole different understanding of physical space. And Serge, you know, we took our cues from Serge. And if Serge wasn't nervous about a situation, neither were we. And, you know, often in places that don't have crews filming a lot, or don't have white people a lot, you're a big, you attract a lot of attention. When you're traveling with Serge Ibaka anywhere in Congo, you are not the main attraction. And so we actually, in that sense, it was like everybody just went to him and we got to watch it happen. So, for the most part, it was really, you know, I and the people I work with, we do a lot of international stuff, and so you just sort of, common sense goes a long way. But it was never really a huge concern. Kinshasa is definitely, you got to be a little careful there, but that's more just dealing with traffic.
My question is for the director. Did your perception of Africa change after going to Congo? Because I got my two African friends over here, and they teach me a lot about Africa, stuff I never known. So did your perception of Africa change after going to the Congo?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. That's a broad question, right? Like, my perception of North America would change if I went from Canada to Mexico. Like, I had lived in South Africa for a bit and traveled in Southern Africa, and I'd been some places in Northern Africa, and so, but definitely Congo was its own thing. And even from the Congo to the DRC, like those two countries are kind of different. And Brazzaville is definitely somewhat more sleepy and mellow than Kinshasa is. But yeah, I mean, Central Africa is definitely tough. This experience was different, I think, and I talked about this morning with one of the questions one of the kids asked. I think there's the level of, I mean, I'd never been in a place like that orphanage before. I'd never been in a place where my sense was people had to hustle as hard as they do to try to get ahead there, and with as little sense that it's going to pay off. It's a hard place. I learned a lot from just the guys who were driving us around and a translator who was with us. And so, you know, I wouldn't say it changed my feelings about Africa. Africa's big, but I definitely learned a lot about Congo and learned a lot about Surge for sure, and what it's going to take to, you know, change a place like that.
One of the things that we've spoken about, with self-determination and kind of having the discipline around the sport itself. It's very hard to get into the NBA, but the discipline itself provides an education and kind of a lifestyle. Could you both talk about how you perceived it, and then how can it move forward?
You're the basketball guy.
Well, I mean, and we had a similar conversation with the kids this morning, to where for me, you know, it's you know, being able to have dreams, you know, being able to understand your passion is really one of the greatest attributes about being human. You know, and for kids, it's not so much about the end result, you know, but having that goal and having the will to want to pursue that goal is the process of what you learn about yourself in attempt to get there. You know, for me, growing up here in Nebraska, my goal was to play in the NBA. Being 6'8", being athletic, you know, I did have the natural God-given abilities to where that was a reality for me. And obviously, I'm not in the NBA now, but everything that I learned along the way changed my life. You know, I got a college education because of it, and I'm in a position to change the lives of hundreds and hundreds of kids, you know, along with their families. So it's really the life skills that can be learned through a sport like basketball, you know, and really just you know, it's one thing to have a dream, you know, to have a goal and really not have the resources around you to be able to pursue it, like what a lot of kids experience that in Africa and in Congo. But it's another thing to develop the will, like a Serge Ibaka, to almost influence circumstances to be in your favor, you know. And I think that's a lesson that, you know, that's every human being have the potential to really realize it for themselves, you know, and so much more than a intellectual understanding, you know.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that, but I think the way you phrased it is the way Serge would for the most part, which is, you know, learning to work hard at something, whether or not that is the thing, that process will change you, and that's more important than the thing, than the result.
How do you, though, tangibly and very explicitly instill that? Because we get that, and I think that's exactly right. It's about the process and the skills, but when you have kids looking at a guy like him who is a clearly a worthwhile role model, but they might not see that at a certain age. Like, maybe, right. Kwong, how did you get to that place of deciding,
right,
it's more about the bigger things or something different?
Well, there's a very strong element of that that's, you know, that's really about the individual personal choice. You know, that's really, you know, I don't know if destiny is the word. But, I mean, one little thing that Serge did mention is the fact that every little thing that he did growing up kind of led to the bigger picture of where he's at now, you know, to where, you know, for me, you know, just the joy of taking a fifth grader, you know, showing him that look, you know, if every single day, if you can't do a left-hand layup, if you take a basketball and you work on it, at some point you're going to be able to do it. You know, being able to see that 2 weeks later they're able to accomplish a left-hand layup, and just that basic skill of how it can be translated to any aspect of their life, to where, you know, a lot of that comes down to the individual, you know, and a lot of what we do is really getting kids to understand who they are, you know, and really them putting them in a position to define who they're going to be tomorrow, you know, and to influence their environment instead of being influenced by their environment.
Hi, Adam. I have a question for you. I love the film. It's amazing and beautiful. I wonder for Serge, when he goes back and he's achieved this amazing position that he has, how does he navigate all the power that he has? And I imagine those two guys are kind of his managers, but it's got to be so overwhelming with so much need. And I just wonder who helps him navigate all this, and how does he continue with that? And also, I'm curious, his relationship with his little girl, how is that going, and do you keep up with them?
So, you know, nobody helps him navigate it. He is, when we shot this, he was 24. Now he's, I think, 26. He is entirely responsible for his extended family on his mother and father's side. And you, when you see him go home, like, this is what really happens. And it's not just his blood relatives. It's everybody wants something from him. And he is, he will run himself ragged and receive everyone and give to everyone he can, to the point that he just gets sick every time he goes. He's there for a couple weeks and he just like crashes. He doesn't know any other way to do it. And so, but he would, I don't think he would ever try to insert a layer between him and anybody else. And that, it goes back to the crowd thing. Like, you know, in other places that would be scary and people would attack athletes, and it's happened, but that's not something that's part of his perception or his reality there. And when he says everyone's family, that's really how he feels. And so he's not trying to navigate anything or mitigate it. He's just trying to be there when he can. And that's inspiring and exhausting.
Amazing.
And but that's it. It's kind of a simple thing for him. And, you know, I think it's going great with Ronnie. I didn't go back this past summer, but I know he went back and did a screening with Ricardo in that neighborhood. And so I know he still sees her and is in touch. And again, that was one of those things that I wasn't sure. You don't know if it's real until you see it. And then when you see it, then you know it's real. And so there's so many things about him where he's just like a very low-key, decent guy.
Was the mother in the picture at all?
She is in the picture. So, like, she'll, you know, they're obviously not romantically involved, but I think he supports them, and so she'll come bring Ronnie, and he'll go to the house and pick her up. And I think eventually, probably he'll move the two of them somewhere closer to where he is. That's my guess. But this was not a photo op relationship in any way, and even you can tell when he talks about it. When he talks about how he feels about not having known for 5 years that he had a daughter, it's a complicated thing for him. But it's when you think about it, it's understandable how it happened. And I think it seems very real to me, and she seems to be doing pretty well. She's great. You know, she's very fun and kind of easygoing and
lovely.
Yeah.
As you said, I think Serge is doing a wonderful job with the skills that he has, and he's very admirable. One thing that I noticed, that he seems to attribute a lot of his success and thankfulness to his religion, and that's not really explored in the film. I'm wondering, and this is out of naivete, what is the religion of Congo? And is his religion the same as what his family believes? Or did you get into that with him?
So, yeah. So there's I think within Congo, there's some diversity of religion, and I think he's actually, I know he's Christian, and since he's lived in Oklahoma City, I think he's identified more with that community. During the time that we were with him, I don't think he goes to church a lot, but I think he definitely identifies and feels a very, very strong motivation to that whatever he's doing isn't about him. It's about something bigger than him, and that's a very strongly held belief. I don't think it's super theologically oriented, but that's how he identifies. And very much so he is... this when he talks about sort of turning the other cheek and talks about that doing good isn't about him and it's not about the person he's doing it for, it's about something bigger. That's I think at the core of who he is.
I was just wondering, I'm kind of a hater, like ESPN and NBA has always annoyed me a lot. But I'm wondering if you have any insight.
That helped pay for the ring, you know, just so... we're on the radio.
Well, I'm wondering if they have more redeeming qualities, like, since making this Grantland is, like, ESPN, right?
It was.
So have they seen this film? Are they inspired? What do they, you know, they pay so much. When there was a figure thrown out about how much Serge Ibaka makes, and then you go home, the juxtaposition of his home, are there any more redeeming qualities that you have insight into about financial contribution from ESPN or NBA or whatever, they hear the story of one of their players that they 24th draft pick, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you know
what I'm asking? Well, I sort of do, and I mean I would say the NBA has a pretty significant investment in Africa, and you know I won't get into the specifics of what they do or what the impact is, but there's NBA, you know, Pros for Africa that Serge is very involved in, and NBA Cares. There are a bunch of certainly efforts to try to bring basketball to the rest of the world and to positively impact communities like Serge's. So he obviously takes a whole lot more of what he earns and brings it to places like that and has created a foundation to get involved there than a lot of other players do. But that's always a matter of personal choice. But I think, you know, he is certainly a great role model as far as athletes go, both for the way he is present and involved, and also for the way he has remained a very grounded individual. And you know, I went to a game with him, and we drove to the stadium in a Hyundai. Like he is now. I mean, it's he needs a bigger car. His legs don't fit well in a Hyundai, but I think he has one other. But the bottom line is he when he's in OKC, he's got a townhouse that's reasonably modest, and his sister lives there too. And he's just a grounded guy. And so I think he's left Congo, but how he started is still very much a part of him.
I know you'd mentioned the limited crossover or dialogue that happens between the Sudanese community in Omaha and the rest of Omaha. What avenues would you suggest as the best opportunities for that to change that are available right now?
That's a great question, and it's a tough question that I don't know if I have the full answer for. But I will say that, I mean, we live in a very, just a great community, very accepting community, to where there's a lot of different services that all individually, they do their own parts to, like Filmstream, you know, at whatever capacity they can to do more, you know, things like this, to where I think it's just taking an assertive approach to being able to build collaborative partnerships, you know, being able to connect with, you know, Omaha Public Schools, you know, being able to connect with the various nonprofits around here to where some of these things do become bad. I mean, they become possible. One great thing that we have done the last 3 years that's really been great in kind of bringing different communities together is, I mean, as simple as a basketball tournament, you know, to where you open it up for teens from West Omaha, North Omaha, South Omaha, you know, Sudanese, and creating a weekend where, you know, kids can interact, you know, and be around each other. But I think that's something that's, it's much bigger than just me, you know, to say what it looks like. I think it's something that, you know, we can all take a bit ownership of our own city, you know, and realize that at the end of the day, you know, the city of Omaha collectively is as good as every individual piece, you know, to where taking a little bit of time to reach out, you know, and just build relationships, really, it goes a long way. So a lot of what my focus is with a lot of our guys is being able to, I guess, put them in a position to develop relationships with people outside of the Sudanese community. The Sudanese, I would say, we're very community-oriented, and we're very, I guess, just reserved, you know, when it comes to really not fully understanding everything outside of the Sudanese community. So a lot of what I do, I mean, there's a number of great individuals here that aren't Sudanese that actually mentor one-on-one a lot of our kids, you know, and they take time out of their week to reach out to these kids and being able to build those bridges. So I think it's something that we can all participate in seeing more of it happen. And that's what I would like to see.
That actually, I'd like to just ask, you know, we've got this great room of engaged people here. So yeah. What can we do? What, you know, what do you need? You need volunteers? What do you need?
Everything. You know, we need everything. You know, but I would say, you know, human resources, I mean, volunteering, whatever it is that you can do is probably the best way to be involved. You know, a lot of what these kids need, I guess, is just, you know, being able to understand that there's options for them in life, you know, that they can become a lawyer, you know, like my good friend Dan, you know, or they can become, you know, a teacher, you know, like Ron. So being able to present people that can offer these different opportunities for them is great. Transportation, you know, if you have 1 or 2 hours to pick up a kid and take him to practice, you know, maybe drop him off, it's something that we always need. And we're to the point to where financially there's a lot that we have to figure out, you know, so financial contributions to where, you know, one of our goals by this summer is making sure that all of our participants are engaged throughout the summer. In the past, we're working with so many kids, and we haven't really been able to do as much as we can for every single one, to where there had to be a selection process to even, you know, just as simple as putting them in a basketball tournament or a game is something that hasn't happened due to financial limitations. You know, I mean, if you are interested in helping in whatever way, feel free to contact me through Brooke. Brian is our president, who's kind of, I guess he's in charge of, you know, reaching out and making sure we are extending out to people that have the passion to serve kids.
Thank you to Adam for coming to Omaha and sharing your film with us, and to Kwong. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
We've heard a question and answer session which followed a special screening of the 2015 documentary film Son of the Congo, directed by Adam Hutnick. The members of the panel were the director of the film and Kwong Duloni, founder and director of the Omaha Talents Academy. This part of the program, presented in collaboration with the Omaha Talents Academy, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 16th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. On the second half of our double feature program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2014 documentary film Mimi and Donna, directed by Sophie Sartain. This part of the program, presented in collaboration with the Meyer Foundation for Disabilities, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 1st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel will be three women who are parents of adult-age children with intellectual disabilities: Carol Miller, Deb Solomon, and Kim Bainbridge, who is also an administrative associate at the Meyer Foundation for Disabilities. The moderator will be the president of the Meyer Foundation, Mary McHale. Mimi and Donna follows a 92-year-old mother, Mimi, who has cared 64 years for Donna, a daughter who has an intellectual disability. Mimi's contemplation of her own mortality is complicated by the likelihood that she will not outlive her daughter, and the need to find Donna a new home. Here now to introduce the panel is Mary McHale.
Those of us who have children with disabilities, you know, this is our life that we live every day, and we worry what's going to happen to them and all that kind of things that you wonder about if you have a typical child, but you definitely wonder about more often, and it's more complex than when you have a child with a disability. So I'm going to let Carol start, and we'll go down. So if you can kind of introduce yourself, give your initial reactions to the film, and then maybe talk about the housing arrangements that you have for your son, and how you got there, and how you decided that was the appropriate place for your son.
Okay. My name is Carol Miller, and I have a son, Kevin Miller, who is 37 years old with intellectual disabilities. Kevin has a seizure disorder, and he's in a wheelchair. Kevin lived with my husband and I and our family. I have two other sons. One was in the audience tonight, and I think the movie was hard for him also. Kevin lived with us until he was 25, and then we decided we would try and find someplace that we thought would be good for Kevin and good for us. And we went on a long journey. It took a long time to find anything because there's really never anything as good as mom, as you learned in the film. Mom does the best. I went on a journey with ARC in the National ARC or chapter in Nebraska, where I was a volunteer and I visited many homes that took care of adults with disabilities. And so I kind of got a picture of what was out there. And then Kevin went through the Westside school system, and he went to work for Mosaic after school. And so I was already with Mosaic, and so then they combined with Martin Luther, and it was a really good opportunity for us because they were building a new home by where we lived. And so we knocked on a lot of doors and tried to get in there, and we did. And so Kevin has been there since he's 25, and he's now 37. It has been a good fit for Kevin and us. He's very much a part of our lives. He's home every weekend, but he has a place to live and a place to go to every day, which is also run by Mosaic. So it's been a good organization for us. We have staffing problems like every organization in this world has, but for the most part, we've been good, and Kevin is happy. And so that's my story. Thank you.
My name is Kim Bainbridge. My son Justin is 20. I gotta think how old he is. He's 26. And he has Down syndrome. Justin has lived independently in his own apartment since January of 2014 with his best friend, Jairus Syme, who is 27 and also has Down syndrome. The guys get less than 10 hours of help a week. The rest of the time, they are on their own, live independently in their apartment. We mainly have help during more the late afternoon, evening hours to help prepare a little bit more nutritious meal. And then they do get some help during the day, going grocery shopping and some things like that. They both have two jobs that they go to, so that keeps them very busy. I can tell you one of the things I really related to when Donna moved out of the house. I mean, I bawled every day for 3 months after Justin moved out. I don't know how it was for you, but it was traumatic for me because we'd never really been separated. I had never been away from him for probably longer than 5 days at any point in time, and the only other person who had ever taken care of him was my mother, his grandmother. So he had never been away from me, and so I would come home from work every night and just bawl. And so that was, you know, he also needs lots of reassurance. I liked in the movie, I mean, Justin, when he sees me now, he's got to have a hug and a kiss, and I think that he misses me, and I still miss him. But for us, it has worked out very well. One of the things why the guys are able to live independently is neither one of them have any medical issues. So no seizure disorders or anything like that, no diabetes. They both can take their own medicine. So that is one of the reasons why they are able to live independently.
Thank you.
I'm Debbie Solomon, and I have two daughters with intellectual disabilities and a multitude of other issues. We have a rare genetic syndrome that doesn't really have a name. But my girls have been living away from us for, it's almost 13 years. They're 38 and 35. And our journey started very similar to Carol's, being that I was active in the community. We were looking at different homes, just curiosity at the time, you know, seeing what was out there. And having two girls who are inseparable, and like most sisters, they're best friends and worst enemies. And I knew I couldn't separate them. So no one, once we got our residential hours, no one had place for two people. So the agency that we were with at the time, who was doing my in-home care because we both worked, and so I needed someone to stay with the girls after school because they cannot be left alone. The agency basically said, go find an apartment. So we did. We looked within a 10-minute radius of our home, and it was like I wasn't going to, you know, have them any further away from me. So if I'd get that call, I could be there instantly. And we took the girls, we found an apartment, and the girls, I don't think, understood really what was going on until we got to pick out the apartment, pick out the furniture, you know, go through everything like you would do with any adult children. And the night that we left them in the apartment for the first time, and again, we had 24-hour staff between the two, my youngest looked out and said, bye, Daddy, bye, Mommy, and slammed the door. And I had prepared myself for all of this. My husband dissolved into a heap of tears. And being that they're both were Daddy's girls, I think it was much harder on him than this sounds really cruel, than it was on me. But we lived in New York for 10 years, and this scenario happened at my kids' school every single day. I was involved. They had special ed PTAs because it was a self-contained school and, you know, the whole nine yards. And I would see elderly parents with kids still at home and some major illness or major or a death or this or that would happen. And my kids were like 5 and 8 when we first started there. And it was like I swore to myself I was never going to let that happen, that everybody else has the beauty of seeing their kids happy and healthy, enjoying life away from them. They go to college, and yes, a lot of them come home now, but it used to be, you know, they were on their own and enjoying their own lives, and that's what my husband and I really wished for my girls. And so they were in this apartment for 11 years, and again, staff changes, and I had had my weekend person for 8 years, and when my weekday staff was changing again, she came to me and said, I'm tired of all these changes. I know the girls are tired of all these changes. What if I become a home teacher? So I kind of looked at her and went, okay. And we went for a month and investigated extended family home versus home teachers, trying to figure out which model we wanted to do, and visited with a few other agencies, and we decided to stick with our agency, and they did home teachers. And so in October 4th, a year ago, I guess a year and a half ago almost, the girls moved into her home. She has a lovely little house in Florence, and they are so happy because she was always their favorite. When one of them's in the hospital, they don't ask for their mother. They ask for Tyree. It's been that way for years, And I'm really pleased that they are so bonded with her. I see them every weekend. Sometimes I see them during the week, depending on what's going on. Very much a part of their lives. We talk to each other a minimum of once or twice a day. You know, how was your day? How was that? They both are working. My youngest is partially in a day program and is just now starting a second volunteer job for 2 days a week because she's in a day program due to the fact that she was very ill when she graduated school. So we had to go that route at the last minute, and she's bonded, made friends, and the staff is great. And so I just really haven't taken her out. And now that she's really healthy, it's time to, you know, let her wings spread a little bit. So she's 3 days a week, she is volunteering and at jobs, and then is it her day program 2 days a week, and it works really well. And we're working with three different agencies. You know, you can mix and match and mesh for what you need to do. And I can see them being in there with their home teacher for years to come. She's like 3 years older than Lisa, and it's working out beautifully.
And she was a newlywed when she came said, so, you know, love me, love my girls, kind of to her husband. So she did this whole thing, and she was a newlywed. So you've heard from three parents who have three different housing situations, and they all chose the, and my son is 17, so I'm not there yet, but I definitely, and he's an only child, so my husband and I have had lots of discussions. We want Daniel out of the house by the time he's 25, if not 23, only for some of the same concern. You know, he needs his own life, whatever that's going to be. We need our own life back. Might sound selfish, but, you know, we still need to do things that we want to do and that we're able to do, and that we don't always have to consider where's he going to go, who's going to watch him, what's going to happen with that kind of stuff. So it's that circle, journey toward independence, and it's different for every child with a disability. So questions that anybody has in the audience or questions about the film?
What if you have a child that would not be able to live independently, and you do want to keep them at home? Are there services that can come into your home then when they're adults? Sounds like there are a lot of services for if they move out. But what if you do want to keep them in the home?
There are home-based services. It all kind of depends on how much you need, and, you know, if they have the residential hours to help pay for them, or you have really good insurance, and their Medicaid will pay for some of it. So it just kind of depends on what you're looking for.
Hopefully your child service coordinator through the Department of DHHS should also be able to put you in line, because you should be able to use, again, if you have residential services. My son's been in the apartment for 2 years and 3 months, and we still do not receive residential services. I asked for residential services as of July 1st, 2010, and there are still 244 adults ahead of my son. So my son's living off of day services, his job, and Social Security.
And so maybe for those of you who are parents and you don't have your child on the waiting list for services, get them on the list, and and you all are more familiar, but that's residential, that's respite, that's, isn't it called community-based
services.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every young adult who graduates school gets day service hours. But the residential hours are totally separate, and there's a 7-year waiting list right now if you end up going to the bottom. But it's a case of get them on that list, and if they're offered to you, and if you're not ready to use them, do not deny them. Ask for them to be done in your home. And that way you won't lose them.
The other thing, one of the biggest mistakes I made was I put Justin down for age 21, receiving residential services. I do not recommend that at all. Put age 18 when they leave high school. Because, see, I believe the list has to be longer than that. I'm out 5 years and 7 months, and there's 244 adults still ahead of Justin. Because I asked for services.
I think it's up to seven. Okay, if Lori's still around. I think it's up to like 1,700 and something. So, yeah, it probably is longer.
I mean, I'm out 5 years and
eight or seven months,
mm-hmm. and there's still 244 adults because I wanted services in 2010. So go ahead and put – because just like what Deb said, even if the waiting list – for residential services disappears in the state of Nebraska, which I don't think any of us will live long enough to ever see that. When you say age 18, maybe you'll have services by the time, you know, your child is 27. I mean, my son's 26, and I don't think I'm going to see residential services before he's 30.
What age can you?
Birth. Birth. My girls were put on at birth.
You go through the Department of Health
and Human Services,
even if you don't have a assigned worker.
You're right. Well, okay. You will if you do early intervention. Mm-hmm. You'll have a service coordinator from birth to three, and then unless you are a waiver child with like a respirator or a feeding tube or whatever, they drop off again until their age. 19, and when you call at 19 for a service coordinator, they'll say, let's just wait. And you can be insistent and get one at 19.
Okay, so I have a school-aged child right now. So
but you still call Health and Human Services and tell them you want to be put, call the intake number, and you want to be put on the list for service coordination residential services. And I mean, my kids were on it for so long, they never asked an age at that time. So.
And there's four categories that you want to be put on. So say, I'm on all four categories. And I forget. But okay. But there's four of them. So get them all.
Do you ladies have a support group that you attend to help you with some of these things?
I think we all went to support groups when our kids were younger.
We had support groups at the school that I was I was always involved with Westside Community Schools, and so we kind of had our own support group. And also I had a support group at Monroe-Meyer because when Kevin was diagnosed when he was 9 months old, they had me take him to Monroe-Meyer right away. And so I was in a support group there that there's probably film running around that building because they would have three other mothers and I would film each one of us interacting with our child, and I would always, you know, try to really be the best interacting mother-child team, you know. But I have no idea what happened to them. It was for some grant they had at the time. But Monroe-Meyer gave us support, and I always had it at Westside Community Schools. And I've met many, many different parents throughout this whole journey, which you do. As any organization you're in with your kids, whether it be sports or Girl Scouts or this, mm-hmm. you bond with those people that you go through all these trials and tribulations with. And so you kind of make your own support group as along the way. But you meet an awful lot of people, caregivers and people, the school system, all of them help you. Monroe-Meyer was a great place for me because it also gave me many caregivers, many, many 13-year-old girls that really wanted to babysit, right. And they were fabulous. So you just find your own way, and you will find support.
And for those of us whose children, so once you turn 12, you age out of commercial child care because that's just how it is. And so if you work outside the home, your job can't be adjusted, so you're home when that bus gets there. So for us, that was the scary part because, what are we going to do? Because he can't get in the door by himself and can't get out, blah, blah, all that stuff. So, I mean, you reach out. We found sitters. one semester we had five different people come into our house because one came on Monday and somebody else Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We found some from MMI. We found somebody I sat on a board with, in fact, Meyer Foundation for Disability. Her daughter was looking for something one afternoon a week. She'd been around kids with disabilities. I'm like, okay, great, you know, come to our house. But it's that networking stuff. Mm-hmm. There's definitely formal support groups. So there's two or three autism groups within Omaha. There's the Down Syndrome Alliance of the Midlands that's in Omaha. There's the Ollie Webb Center. I mean, there's different ones like that. And then it's those, so your kid's doing Challenger, your kid's doing adaptive swimming, your kid's doing a Special Olympics sport, and you talk to those. Sorry, guys. It's usually the moms that they're talking among each other, and they're, you know, so you do what, and who do you do for that? And then you look for, at least in my case, so I call Kim a lot because, you know, she has a kid with Down syndrome and they aren't all the same. But so what did you do about this, you know, as Daniel gets older, because I know she's gone that path. And then I also ask parents who, so Daniel will have to apply for SSI in a couple of months. So I talk to, you know, parents who did it within the last year. So what did you do? How long did it take? You know, all that kind of stuff. So you kind of reach out. And some people like to do that. Some people don't want that at all, and that's okay too, and that's what the internet is for. So you can go in and, you know, you can chat and find out information that way. It's all in what works best for that person and for that family also.
You know, and being that my kids are so much older than everybody else's.
I was
35.
Yeah,
they're not that much older.
That's true.
That things were different too back then. All the really that was there, Monroe Meyer, and they had pilot parents through the ARC of Omaha, or it was GOARC in those days. Now it's the Ollie Webb Center, the ARC of Omaha. They have parent-to-parent groups, and they also have PRISM meetings, which, not prison, PRISM meetings. And you get to meet parents there, and they always highlight a topic and have a speaker. But, you know, some of us have known each other through our school systems, through, you know, I know that my girls were, we were all in pilot parents through the ARC of Omaha when it first started, and that helped us a lot because we didn't have a diagnosis. And so we didn't fit anywhere. So, you know, it was nice to have a generic group to be able to go. And then when we left town due to my husband's transfers and came back, I mean, it was like old home week. I knew exactly where to go and basically picked up with old friends, and it was wonderful. So if you're a support group kind of person, you make one connection, and through that one connection, you know, it kind of explodes.
I wondered if any of you had experience in other states and how Nebraska compares to other places across the country.
I do not. I've only been in Nebraska. Kevin was born here, and we found all our services, so I don't have any experience with other states.
I do not either. Justin was born in Nebraska and have always lived in Omaha, so sorry.
Okay, my girls were born here. We left Nebraska when my youngest was three, went to Kansas, Wichita, Kansas, for 2 years, and then we were on Long Island in New York for 10. Services here are far better than either of those places. And every time that my husband was offered a position somewhere, I would call the state ed department, you know, because the girls were still in school. And believe it or not, and I'll never forget this one, in Louisiana, because he was offered a wonderful job in Baton Rouge, called state ed, and the lady on the phone said to me, "Honey, if you want special ed, don't come here." I know there's parts of North Carolina that are good, and then there are parts of North Carolina that are not. It depends how close you are to the university, because that's where a lot of the bigwigs are. Kansas used to be, like Nebraska, a forerunner in the country, and they've now kind of taken a back step. What I can say is our new DD director in Nebraska, I think she's going to be phenomenal, and I think we're going to see a lot of changes, good changes, mm-hmm. in the coming years. It's not going to happen instant, but it's coming. But I would suggest, especially if you have school age, call the state ed department, ask them about how the services are. And most companies, if you're being transferred or even at your own expense, go and visit before you commit, because sometimes what you hear on the phone is not accurate. So,
and the challenge is, if your child receives those DD services and you move to another state, you start all over again. So nothing is transferable. You go back to the bottom of the list and fill out all the same paperwork, even though, you know, your child's diagnosis hasn't changed. Just crossing a state boundary, you still have to go through and do all that all over again.
Yeah, my family's in Florida, and they keep saying, you've got to come, you've got to come, you've got to come. Services are great. Well, I've had three parents that I know of come back to Nebraska from Florida because they were not. So it just kind of depends on what you're doing, because as I tell my family, I love you, but I'm not moving. New York has some good, but there a lot of their facilities, if you're talking like residential, are through the ARC. It's AHRC in New York, and they're group homes, but you can't get into them because they're all full. A friend of mine's son is at a place called Devereaux, which is upstate New York. She lives close to New York City. He's upstate New York because that was, at the time, where he had, you know, the only opening they had. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, everybody.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we presented a double feature. On the second half of the program, we heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2014 documentary film Mimi and Donna, directed by Sophie Sartain. The members of the panel were three women who are parents of adult-age children with intellectual disabilities: Carol Miller, Deb Solomon, and Kim Bainbridge, who is also an administrative associate at the Meyer Foundation for Disabilities. The moderator was the president of the Meyer Foundation, Mary McHale. On the first half, we heard a question-and-answer session which followed a special screening of the 2015 documentary film Son of the Congo, directed by Adam Hutnick. The members of that panel were the director of the film and Kwang Duloni, founder and director of the Omaha Talents Academy. This program, presented in collaboration with the Omaha Talents Academy and the Meyer Foundation for Disabilities, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 16, 2016, and Tuesday evening, March 1, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson and Patrick Kinney of FilmStreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.